The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books Podcast.
Rob Larson is a professor of economics at Tacoma Community College in Washington State and the author of Bleakonomics. He's written broadly, including for In These Times, Dollars and Cents, and Jacobin, and he's appeared on alternative radio as well as other programs. He is also the author of the book Capitalism versus Freedom, which is out now from Zero Books. It's Wednesday, June 27th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to thank Ben W., Neil, Luco, and Horatio, along with 360 others for supporting the Zero Books podcast on Patreon. Patreon supporters get access to the Inside Zero Books podcast, Symptomatic Redness, and the Alternatives podcast. Counting Zero Squared, Patreon supporters get access to two podcasts every week. The music you're listening to right now is the French national anthem, La Marseillaise, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Rob Larson and I discuss Capitalism versus Freedom.
Rob Larson is a professor of economics at Tacoma Community College in Washington State, and he is the author of Bleakonomics, as well as a book called Capitalism versus Freedom, that's coming from Zero Books. He's written for other publications like In These Times, Dollars and Cents, and, of course, Jacobin. And he appeared on alternative radio with David Barsamyan. Is that how you say it?
Indeed.
Okay. So, and he's a guest this week on Zero Books. So, Rob, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure, Doug. Thanks for having me.
So, the title of your book, actually, before we start talking about your book for Zero Books, tell me about Bleakonomics. What was that about, and who published it?
Bleakonomics was my first book that came out 2012 from Pluto Press, my friends over in London. And that was in part a collection of some articles I had written. It's basically a three-parter. It has three sections. The first one's about our big environmental problems caused by our economy and our military systems. The second one is about sort of social analysis and what we can say about classes within an economy like the United States. And the third one was about the financial crises that we keep having. So that one, that's why it's Bleakonomics, because it's sort of three horrible economic problems that we have.
And that came out in 2012?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Okay. So that's like 4 years after the big economic crisis of 2008, which, and right after Occupy Wall Street. You know, for a long time, I think, first of all, it's just difficult for me to comprehend that it has been a decade since the economic crisis of 2008.
I know. It's true. That's 10 years ago, and I'm finding it slightly harder to get my students to see why it's important now that it's 10 years.
Right. No, I mean, I think that moment, which defined for me, like, defined the Marxist left for me, because I'd kind of been a Noam Chomsky anarchist liberal type for most of my adult life. And then the economic crisis hit and I realized I didn't understand why it was happening. And I actually started podcasting, in 2009. And one of the things I was doing was trying to figure out what was going on with the economy and with the country and with the world. And, you know, at the very beginning of the podcast, my wife would do a Titanic factoid at the end of each podcast, and at the time it was like a hit you over the head metaphor for our circumstances. You know, the Titanic, we're all sinking. Now, I don't think necessarily people would even get it why she was doing that.
Yeah, and it's fitting too, because the Titanic at the time was considered the, you know, the apex, the high achievement of the Western engineering tradition. And it was indeed the biggest physical object that man had ever made to move on the Earth's surface. And it obviously was ill-fated. But similarly, Wall Street, I mean, those firms, at least until the rise of Silicon Valley, they were the undisputed ruling sector of the economy with the most power and the largest firms and the most important stature and the most government influence. And yeah, it was a complete implosion. So it's so well chosen. Your wife was onto something with that.
Yeah. And, you know, and then Barack Obama had just been elected. And I really think that one of the things that the election of Trump has done is put to rest the concern about the financial crisis for most of the American left.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question because, I mean, what it's, of course, really doing is making it more likely. Of course, the Republicans and Trump have been eager to remove what relatively limited regulation we put back on Wall Street. I actually wrote a little bit about that Dodd-Frank re-regulation of Wall Street bill back when it came out, and it was fairly mild in its requirements, and now most of it's been stripped away or undone by Congress. So objectively, it's making another crisis somewhat more likely to happen.
Well, this is something we should maybe debate a little bit, because after you know, interviewing a whole bunch of people about the economic crisis back in 2008, what I came to was a conclusion that while financialization and deregulation were problems that didn't help the our economy, that the underlying reason, like the real cause for the economic crisis, was the tendency for the rate of profit to decline, which is just kind of always present in capitalist societies. If you have enough regulation, you may still end up in an economic crisis.
It's definitely not a guarantee you're going to avoid one. I mean, that's very clear. As far as stuff like the falling rate of profit goes, I mean, you know, there's a lot to say about that. And I just personally come out of, you know, again, my undergraduate work was in biology. So, like, I come out of this whole natural science background that makes me a little more broadly, maybe skeptical of these sort of big framework ideas of the social sciences. And the rate of profit, I feel like it's just really historically contingent. Like it has a lot of different patterns that it's shown. That wasn't exactly what I most connected it with, at least the last financial crisis in my mind. I mean, to me, it was deregulation and that huge rise in wealth inequality. Because wealthy people, you know, they invest that wealth, whereas middle class people will spend it on, you know, healthcare or vacations or paying off credit card debt. Wealthy people invest it, and that's where these modern bubbles that we get every 10 years that explode, that seems to be where they come from too. I think really what this sort of thing shows, again, coming out of the background I have, is that in the social sciences, there's such a, I feel like there's a lower level of understanding than we can refer to confidently in the hard sciences, and you can legitimately point to a lot of real contributing factors in these kind of big, complicated historical episodes.
This distinction between the social sciences and the hard sciences is really interesting because I almost hear you naturalizing the capitalist economy.
If that's happened, unintentionally.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, oh, well, we can't turn to the social sciences to understand our society. We have to turn to the natural sciences because, what, our society is a natural fact? In which case, you know, we might be able to change it, but I guess what we'd have to do is start on the level of biology to change it. Like some sort of transhumanism would be the way to go.
Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
Right. But if you don't mean that, right? You just mean that we don't understand society very well.
Yeah, to me, my whole point in my mind is that we should just have a little more humility in our social science proclamations. I feel like we are the tendency is to be on shakier ground than we reflect with in the way we speak a lot of the time. And I feel like there's plenty of that to go around on all social science sides. And I mean, I've, again, spent years reading Marxists, and I really, you know, I can't imagine not having their work to draw on. I just feel like a little more humility would be handy, I think.
I just went to the Left Forum, right? And I went to Marxist panels. And the problem I find in the Marxist left is that everyone is absolutely confident that their social science is complete.
And no one agrees with each other, often not even in the same groups. I mean, you know, it's the splitting happens all the time. But it be, so I understand where you're coming from. Like a little humility is good. Okay, let's start with the questions about your book. So your, the title of your book is Capitalism versus Freedom. Why that title? Why that juxtaposition between capitalism and freedom?
Yeah, well, the title was, it was half of the idea for the project at one point. If you're ever studying economics or just ever arguing with a conservative person about the economy, very, in the United States at least, very quickly, you're going to be referred or to or handed a copy of a couple of sort of classic conservative texts on how the economy works and what our policies should be. And the ones that I found people run into the most, it was certainly true for me, was Milton Friedman's 1960s classic Capitalism and Freedom, which is all about how capitalism and the marketplace provide us with the freedom from other powerful institutions coercing our behavior and making you do different things. And the classic understanding on the most basic level is that big, powerful institutions limit the freedom of individuals because they can make you do things like pay taxes or, you know, purchase something from a monopoly or something. So he took the view that capitalism and freedom are very tightly conjoined. And the other book you tend to have referred to you a lot is, of course, maybe better known, Friedrich Hayek's book, you know, The Road to Serfdom, about how all of our New Deal or in Europe, social democratic policies, regulations, taxes on the rich, these are taking us toward a position where the government has so much power, it will make us into serfs, you know, the unfree, immobile workers of the Middle Ages and much of the world economy. Well, I, for a while, have found those arguments to be not completely persuasive. And so when I got around to deciding to write a book-length rebuttal, I decided to call mine Capitalism versus Freedom, The Toll Road to Serfdom, which I think speaks to the fact, I sort of make this basic argument in the book, that business entities, market enterprises, companies, and corporations can become powerful monopolies and exert very large amounts of power over us as well. And I look at different ideas of freedom and how these things come together. But that's how the book got its confrontational sounding title. Indeed, he's a very generous man. well enough to badger him on email occasionally, as many of us on the left do. He's obviously a huge figure. He's definitely, I think, one of the main figures of the left in the 20th century. And also, I will say he's been very generous toward my work. I'm actually writing my third book right now, and he's written a generous cover comment for all three, for every book I've written. I think that's partially because I think he sees something in my work, because, of course, famously, he's coming out of the hard sciences, too, with his linguistics background and his globally recognized scientific stature. I'm saying that I have a somewhat parallel path for my more humble part.
Well, okay, so what I was going to ask you is, I think that this distinction between capitalism and freedom is one that Chomsky mentions fairly frequently. I mean, I've heard him talk a number of times, I've read a few of his books, and he tends to think that capitalism is a limit to freedom. The question is always, how do we recognize the ways in which historically capitalism did expand the realm of freedom and at the same time try to move beyond that level?
That's exactly, I think the way you just put that kind of perfectly speaks to the issue, because, I mean, every, you know, you read these books that I'm sort of confronting. And when you read my book, one thing I think you can say in its credit is, unlike most people, like, I want the other side to have their say. So I spend a little time in the book quoting Friedman and Hayek. And This is where everyone gets into trouble, is they say, well, the other side says this. And then they say some caricatured, uncharitable version of it. You should bring in their strongest advocates to make the case in their own words. And then you can tear it to shreds. And so I try to give them that opportunity in the book. And when you look at some of that material, what tends to happen is they'll say, well, you know, the growth of freedom historically is in capitalist economies with some form of republic politically, you know, parliament or, you know, a U.S. style, republic. and that's where our freedom has come from and so forth. Like, it's completely right. And this, to me, is one thing that I feel like the Marxists have really contributed, and they certainly added a lot to my understanding with this. Just that that is part of big global systems come and go over time. Very frequently, when they're new, they're responding to some big social problem or some need. And over time, you know, and like Thorstein Veblen, the great U.S. social scientist, said, they have the weaknesses of their strengths. Like, they come into existence to solve some problem, but over time they develop their own problems as they elaborate themselves. And so markets and capitalist economies, I mean, like the republic governments that we have in Western Europe and North America, you know, they originated in this period where we were coming out of having feudal economics, and politically we had aristocrats and monarchs. And so both just having civil elections and having some kind of marketplace were huge legitimate advances for the economies when those things arose. But I think it is telling too, and you kind of referred to this in your question, that, like, again, if you look at my book and see what these great, you know, conservative intellectuals and defenders of capitalism have said, usually their argument comes to, look how much freer our society is, and then they'll compare it to others, and they'll compare it to either, you know, the medieval economies themselves, or some shabby 20th century dictatorship. They say, our society is freer than the Tsarist Russia, so ours is free. That is such a low, that is a hilariously low bar. Does our economy work? Well, it's better than having a dictatorship. Oh, very nice. How impressive.
The thing about Milton Friedman and Hayek were that it was not just that they were defending capitalism, right? They were defending capitalism from an aspect or a political school of thought or an economic school of thought that was well within capitalism, which is Keynesianism, right? And they were defending those who want to manage the markets and try to make capitalism more rational. They were arguing for, like, an unfettered market-led economy. Although, if you look at the neoliberal project, of course, that's not actually what was happening at all. And it wasn't even what they advocated exactly either. There was a guy named Chris Cattrone who quoted, I think it was Hayek meeting with Milton Friedman. I'm not sure, but anyway, one of them, I think it was definitely not Milton Friedman, accused the other two of being socialists because they wanted to get the state to help the market, you know, to redirect money and towards investment to encourage the market and that kind of thing, which made them socialists.
That's too much intervention.
That's right. And
that is such a living tradition on the right. I just saw Navarro, our great president, what's-his-name's inspiring trade advisor. He referred to that communique from the G7 group that the president refused to sign.
Mm-hmm.
He called it a socialist communique from the G7 great capitalist powers. But yeah, it involves – I'm sure if we ask him, it would be the exact same thing that you just referred to that fellow criticizing Friedman and Hayek for. It includes the implied acceptance of some government policy. even if just a system for property rights, like, even that is testing the waters.
Right. No, you gotta go purists. Full ANCAP here. You gotta say no. Private armies will protect property. Yeah.
The private courts, great. No downside.
Right. Right. So the truth here, though, is that Friedman and his ilk weren't ANCAPs. They were just trying to move against Keynesian spending and Keynesian redistribution policies and undo the New Deal.
Ooh.
to some large degree, and that's what the Project Neoliberalism has been about, right? It's slowly deregulating and moving away from the welfare state.
Indeed. But I think that distinction too, like, that actually is a really interesting one. Like, certainly, the neoliberal project, it's mainly fulfilling, you know, like, the Friedmanite policy agenda. And of course, he was a influential policy advisor for Reagan and Thatcher, although Friedman never took on an official policy position. He was considered very influential. But also, again, yeah, considered to be something of a sellout by, as you said, yes, the ANCAPs, the anarchist capitalists. And partially for that reason, in my book, I've got a few of those characters alongside Friedman and Hayek making the case for the free, completely unregulated free market. So I've got Murray Rothbard in there a couple of times, and of course, von Mises himself, wherever exactly we might put him on the conservative economic spectrum. To me, these guys are all part of the galaxy of far-right economics, so I wanted them all to be included. I want super purists and the mere conservatives.
What do you think their strongest argument is? When you said you try to present them in their, you know, in their best apparition, you know, the best version of these guys, what do you think that they – I mean, first of all, what I would say about them is that they really believed it. I mean, these – I think the left tends to think that guys like Milton Friedman are just greedy bastards who want to step on the poor. And that really isn't the case. I mean, they may be misguided for some self-interested reasons that they're not quite aware of or something like that. But it's hard to psychoanalyze, you know, the dead. And so, but it seems to me that they really believe in what they're saying. So what was it that they were arguing that might be in any way persuasive or that we need to take seriously before we overcome it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think what you said makes a lot of sense. Like, one real strength that they have as a tradition is the sincerity, as you just said. It's really believed. To me, I mean, the thing I think of, like, their main advantage is that it's ultimately a simple argument. Markets are free, government's authoritarian. Freedom means less authoritarianism, so more markets, less government. Like, that is a simple-ass ideology. You can explain to anybody standing at the bus station. It's a complete Manichaean, goofy caricature, but if you're willing to accept it, you know, you don't have to spend years studying that to understand it fully. Whereas, you know, the reality is the social world's complex and messy, and there's all kinds of power that come from different social sectors, and this is what I try to get the hands dirty with in my book a little bit. So that's the Manichaean simplicity of that argument to me is the strongest case. And I mean, if you read these texts, which if, you know, I read several of their books in the course of researching this project, I had to accept that it would mean a large amount of conservative reading, which everyone should, you know, you should be doing that, reading the other side. That's what you do if you have, I think, real conviction, but it is a bit of a slog. And what you discover is, yeah, they put that argument, they substantiate that argument by looking at, if your goal is to go after one social institution that's been around for hundreds of years, there's plenty of humiliating episodes and mistakes and folly. And, you know, authoritarian governments have an almost endless list of cruel, ham-fisted, unfeeling, violent historical behaviors. And you can fill a large book up with that stuff. And as long as you have this nice framework, well, markets are free, anyone can challenge AT&T's phone monopoly. If you're willing to just pass over that quickly and not think about it too much, and you're not used to bringing critical thinking to the ideas you already like, then, like, that's strong.
It's rhetorically strong. And it speaks to people's lived experience, right? Because
indeed,
if you,
everyone's been pushed around by the DMV, you know.
Right. And also people go to work and they pushed around as employees, but when they go out to, you know, shop, they're treated well. They don't think of the job market as being part of the market, I think.
No, that's just a weird reality. That's actually an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that, but that is a true – people do. I tell my students, you know, it's a market. We're the supply of labor and employers are the demand. And I can see them all thinking, like, wow, I guess that is true. It is somehow outside of people's orbit of their understanding of markets for some reason.
Because you're so desperate to sell your labor, it doesn't even feel like you're taking it to market. Like, usually
that's
if you
– yeah. It's – you know, if you've got products to sell and the price is low, you know.
Or I think most people, like, they might have a house that they're going to sell. Like,
yeah.
Really, you know, and it's like, oh, I'll price it high and see what I can get. Yeah, you can't just say, okay, I'm going to take myself off the job market for a while and my value will appreciate or something. You know, everyone don't go to work for – I mean, I guess it does happen. Like, there are big strikes or when you get to near full employment, you can start to see – how, you know, the price of labor goes up.
Yeah, but it's a slow process. You know, right now we're at least kissing what everyone considers to be full employment. And I can tell you, you know, I read the Wall Street Journal every day, and every economist from the Federal Reserve to the Journal editorial board is, with the job market this tight, why are wages and salaries so sluggish still? They're only barely starting to really move upward after many quarters of very low unemployment. People can't imagine that there's a role for organization and bargaining power. That, like you just said, kind of comes from that labor movement, that organization. Yes, you're more productive, but that doesn't mean you're going to get a share of that productivity gain. You need a union to twist your boss's arm if you're going to get a share.
Or the market might do some of that too. I mean, if you can't hire the workers you need except by giving them more money, then you will eventually do that if you can, right, as a capitalist. But
firms hate that, though, as soon as that takes place. Like, all the tech firms right now are united in saying, why can't we have a sensible immigration policy? And that to them is not accept these desperate Central Americans whose countries we destroyed in the Reagan days. To them, it's, can we bring in more trained software writers from South Asia so that we can drive down salaries for our expensive programs? So even when the market does lead to those higher salaries, companies will move heaven and earth to stop it. So
about it. You told me what the appeal of this was. I wanted to actually bring forward this clip that I heard from Milton Friedman talking to Francis Fox Piven.
You always are talking about mixed systems, and I challenge you to find a single example in history at any time of any society where people have been relatively free, and I don't mean merely what you call merely economic freedom. I mean freedom in the full sense. I mean freedom of individuals to pursue their own objectives, their own values, to live their lives. I want you to name me any society in which you've had any large measure of that freedom, where capitalism and free enterprise has not been the predominant mechanism for controlling economic activity. Not the sole mechanism, but the dominant one. I want you to name me one exception.
Your conception of freedom, does that apply in Chile today?
Where the Chile is not politically free. Chile today does not have political freedom, and I do not condone, but let me go on for a moment, if you will. You raise the question, let me answer it. Chile is not a politically free system, and I do not condone the political system. But the people there are freer than the people in communist societies because government plays a smaller role, because the free enterprise that has been emerging has been cutting down the fraction of the total income of the people spent by government, because unemployment has been going down, output has been going up, food production has been going up. The conditions of the people in the past few years has been getting better and not worse. They would be still better to get rid of the junta and to be able to have a free democratic system. What I have said, and what I repeat here, is that it's a necessary condition. You cannot have a free society, in my opinion, and I know no counterexample, and I challenge you to produce one.
This goes back to what I was talking about before, is how the neoliberal guys like Friedman were really reacting to another school of thought within capitalism, because Francis Fox Piven in this debate with Milton Friedman was really talking about intervention in the market to regulate it rather than developing something like socialism.
Indeed.
And he asked her to name a free society that was not also capitalist, and she sort of boxed herself in because the truth was, if they had been honest with each other, they would have both said, yeah, we both love capitalism, I think. I'm not sure what Francis Fox Piven's avowed politics are.
Yeah, to me, there's sort of two problems there. And I guess Piven and Friedman, was that time they were on Donahue's show? Is that that famous exchange? Just out of curiosity.
It might have been. I don't know. I just saw a clip, you know, on YouTube, right?
I would say the first issue there is, of course, that let's start this way. I'd say the answer to that question is there are very few examples to give, because as soon as any society takes steps toward being free outside of a capital, or really doing anything outside of a capitalist framework, immediately capitalist powers take action on an organized, aggressive basis to destroy it. And usually they're very open about it, in the sense that they'll say, oh, this country, it's going through a revolution. They're taking property away from the big industrialists or financiers who have been directing the economy and been in charge and deciding who lives and who dies for all these years. They're taking over it. They're terrorists. We have a threat to our security in some way. And so almost in every instance where societies break away from a private property rights oriented system, they get attacked, and those governments are the ones that get overthrown. And what's interesting to me is that this happens regardless of what direction they're going in. So it could be a conservative, religious-oriented, clerical revolution like the Iranian Revolution in 79. It could be a revolution toward like real participatory, real socialism, where workers are actually involved in deciding what happens in the economy. There you could look at, say, Spain in the 30s, in the Republican Spain during the Spanish Civil War. But that's a perfect example. Like right away, you know, Hitler and Mussolini and the fascist powers are pouring aid into the fascist elements, and that's a civil war, and Stalin's giving aid to the communists who are very much aligned with him. Like there's very little opportunity for free societies to arise except within the most powerful societies like the U.S. or a few others. So my first thought is, yeah, you can't name one of those countries, Friedman, that's free and not capitalist, because as soon as a society stops being capitalist in any direction, everyone pulls out the knives and stabs it like a mob around Caesar. So that's my first thought there. The second thing I would say is that, as usual, Friedman's begging the question that our society is free. And it's definitely free, again, as he will tell you, compared to the feudal era, compared to Stalinism, and other authoritarian, strict, totalitarian regimes. Yes, we look pretty good next to that. But again, what a hilariously low bar that is. So to me, there's sort of two issues there. Whenever anyone wants to take their country in a direction besides capitalist private property rights, whether it's for social democracy like Guatemala in the 50s or for strict religious, fundamentalism like Iran in the 80s or, actual socialism like Spain in the 30s, those societies get stabbed in the back from every direction. So it's tough. And then again, our society is not quite so free for the reasons I argue about in the book.
Yeah, so you talk about Isaiah Berlin in your book, and when you're talking about trying to define freedom, and you're starting, again, I think, from a kind of a conservative perspective on freedom, the Friedman perspective, where it comes down to kind of negative freedom, freedom from the feudal lord or freedom from the state. But Isaiah Berlin had a dual notion of freedom.
Yeah, and to me, if you take a look at the book, the first thing in it is a relatively short introduction, basically just a couple pages, exactly trying to just look at the most common ideas about what freedom and liberty are and what philosophers have had to say about that. And I'll say this right now with no shame, I am not a philosopher, I'm an economist. So I've read some of this stuff in my just broad social science background, but obviously there's a lot of extent to this. And to me, for my purposes, I just wanted to lay out the most basic views of freedom and then show, in my view, for the arguments that I make, that capitalism kind of fails to satisfy those conditions of freedom. So, what we're referring to is Isaiah Berlin wrote a couple of, a number of very famous pieces about the philosophy of liberty and freedom. And one of his famous ones is his two concepts of liberty. And exactly what you said, he lays out a pair of them. Negative freedom refers to your freedom from other people or institutions telling you what to do. So, yeah, the church or the state or some group of people in your society, to the extent they can tell you what to do and limit your freedom to do what you want to do, we consider that to be a violation of negative freedom. And so in that point of view, power, like social power, the ability to make someone do something, that was seen to be an opponent of freedom. But Berlin also discussed a complementary idea of freedom called positive freedom, which is your freedom to do different things. So your freedom, like your right to freedom of speech, we consider that to be, at least in a lot of contexts, a positive freedom. And Berlin, in that famous essay, he's much more skeptical or finds more problems with positive freedom, thinks it could be used to coerce people. Like, so, if I'm a noble in the medieval period or, a military dictator today, I'm free to tell people what to do. Well, we would say, okay, yes, you, the powerful person there, you have a positive freedom to tell people what to do, but that's violating their negative freedom. And sometimes people use the phrase hegemonic liberty to describe that. Like, okay, you're free to violate other people's freedom And so on those sort of grounds, Berlin was more skeptical of that. And so if you look at Friedman and Hayek and the other sort of more conservative or all the way to the ANCAP thinkers about capitalism, they tend to take the position that, you know, a more conservative position that negative freedom is the one that you like want to take seriously and focus on, because positive freedom can be used to push people around and so forth. My book and their conclusion from all this is that capitalism provides negative freedom because you're free to choose in the marketplace what you want to buy. No one can tell you what to do. And yeah, markets don't give you positive freedom, like the right to have a share of the consumption of society, you know, right to some basic resources. But we, you know, that's not a real form of liberty, or we don't like that one so much. So the kind of the conventional view is that capitalism gives you negative freedom and not so much positive freedom, and that's good. My argument is capitalism fails both. It failed to provide positive freedom, which people basically agree with, because within the marketplace, there's no, you know, it's, you know, a little more, you know, law of the jungle style. If you can't market a product that makes you money, then you just have nothing and waste away and starve. But their claim would be that it does provide negative freedom because you're free of power and coercion from others. I think that's an extremely untenable position to take if you look at the concentration of wealth, the concentration of market share in giant companies, whether they're incorporated or not, sort of a separate interesting issue. But regardless of the exact organization of businesses, they're powerful and they coerce us all the damn time, whether they have a full monopoly or not. There's lots of ways it works out. And that's what I sort of argue in that big first chapter of my book, is trying to make that case that despite what Milton Friedman says, that capitalism provides negative freedom, and that's the big core value that we have. Not really. You know, again, it's an improvement on feudal times, but that's not saying a hell of a lot.
You don't actually have the freedom from work, right? You don't have the freedom from selling your labor if you don't own property. That is a kind of coercion.
And that to me is one of the most, that specific point is really interesting. If you, again, flip through capitalism and freedom, or of course, Friedman has a lot more expansive books where he deals with issues in more depth. That book and his other best known book, Free to Choose, that he wrote with his wife, Rose. Those are the most well-known books, and so I kind of focus on those because, again, those are the ones that get handed to undergraduates in business schools to make them believe in the system. So that was my part. But if you look at what he says in that book, at one point he says, well, of course, in the marketplace, even if you have a few big companies dominating a market, you're still free. You still have negative freedom because – and he just says this. He says, because every household is free to produce for itself. That's from memory, but, you know, that's almost the exact words that he used in the book. He says, every household is free to produce what itself. What a fatuous view that is. That, to me, like, this guy's a Nobel Prize winner. That's extremely problematic. Like, you're free to produce for yourself. We are not in the era of piecework, you know, garment industry anymore. Like, producing things for the large majority of us requires some capital. Some productive material, some tools or equipment that you use at your job, whatever it is, that's physical capital. That is extremely concentrated ownership of that in the wealthiest households. So the fact that he just asserts that some penniless family living in the slum of Rio de Janeiro, oh, just produce for yourself. Holy shit, you genius. I can't believe they didn't think of that, those poor people.
Right. I mean, he sounds like a crust punk, you know? He sounds like he believes in this sort of like backyard garden, you know, we don't need to wear deodorant, we'll just, you know, dig our own latrines somewhere. Of course, if you try that, you're going to find you run up against, all sorts of problems. And also you're probably going to starve. The people don't own enough land to just grow their own crops anymore, right? With that whole mode of life.
Yeah, it would be own some land or an orchard or something. But even that,
he's assuming that capitalism doesn't really exist the way it does, because he's assuming, oh yeah, you still have the possibility of returning to subsistence farming, right? And even then, at the time when capitalism came into being, that was not a possibility for people. They were thrown off their land,
indeed,
and forced into labor.
That's kind of the classic thing. Like Marxists, again, whose work I benefit from continuously, their deserve credit for highlighting the historical practice of enclosure, just what you said, and the rise of the market economy. It begins with taking all these common lands and all these ecosystem services and saying these were something that everyone used so you could all keep your flocks of sheep alive or gather wood or whatever you're getting, or get water, whatever you're benefiting from. We're going to make that private property of some lord and then some industrialist douchebag later. That these guys talk like that never happened. And I have to say, too, like, this idea really is imminent in capitalism today. Like, half of, you know, everyone these days talks about the gig economy. And, oh, you know, you're trying to make money? Well, you know, rent out your car for Uber, or rent out your apartment for Airbnb, or make some crafts and sell them on Etsy. This idea that you don't need any capital at all and you'll be able to get by just fine, that, you know, like Friedman said, you can produce for yourself. This is still so important for justifying our low security, low income gig economy, as they call it. Like, people still think, oh yeah, you make some crafts on Etsy and you sell them and that'll pay for your U.S. health insurance. No problem. It's this sweet, sad naivete, which they look down on whenever some socialist fails to completely heap scorn on, you know, state socialism. Oh, you think it'll be nice, but it'll be Stalin gassing the Ukrainians soon. Like, for God's sake, if you guys are going to be hard-nosed there, fine, but then don't have this gauzy view that I'll be able to pay for my rent selling cutesy crap on Etsy and giving people lifts on Uber. Like, it's just a complete fantasy.
Well, some people make a living barely on Uber, but certainly I don't know how many people make a living from Etsy. And
conservatives, when they occasionally can be bothered to read the left's opinions about something and then criticize it, usually they just make up a caricature. But when it happens, they always say that the left is obsessed with power. Like, you're obsessed, the feminists are obsessed with power that husbands have over them when they, you know, are the only ones who have the franchise and control the household money. And you socialists are obsessed with the power of companies and all the influence they hold over society. That's usually the cause, that's the charge that's leveled. But I mean, it is a fact that, like, power is part of marketplace negotiations. It amazes me because you can see it in the blandest places. Like, if you pick up the Wall Street, again, the Wall Street Journal, you know, the boringest conservative business oriented news source, whenever they describe negotiations, like, between two companies, like what Netflix is going to pay some movie studio to show some of their movies, or what a construction company is going to pay steel makers for steel to make the frames for their structures. They never, like, supply and demand is always part of it, but they inevitably, as part of being good business reporters, mention, well, there is a bargaining power issue here too, because this company needs the steel soon, or they don't have any other suppliers, or is this company isn't so desperate for the transaction. Like, issues of market power just immediately come up in conservative business analysis. But when you look at our work, it's, why are you guys so focused on power? Why do you insist that it's so important? We think it's, you think we're obsessed with it because you have a weird refusal to admit that it exists anywhere except people paying taxes.
So, you know, you're an economist. I mean, you teach economics at Tacoma Community College. So you're teaching undergraduates, right, for the most part? And these are people who are going to be going on to business school or get business majors mostly?
I am formally in a business program. Yes, we get business people, accountants, but we do get a lot of folks just interested in the broader social sciences too. I have a lot of them come into the class as well. So it is a mixture, I guess.
Yeah. And so when you teach economics, are you, well, I guess what I'm going to ask you, this is kind of one of my last questions here, but how do you define socialism? And do you think of it along economic lines? And then when you're teaching economics, what kind of economic schools do you find yourself aligning with as an economist?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple of parts there. I mean, the first thing is that to me, as far as how I talk about socialism in the classroom, I almost never do. That to me is teaching. To me, that's very separate from the writing and the research and the advocacy I do.
If you were in a literature department, you could teach socialism, but
in the social science program with my fellow liberal sociologist people and so on. Yes. But frankly too, I mean, Norman Finkelstein, to pick a figure who's associated with these questions, like, he said that it's, you know, again, I'm misquoting him, but he said, it's a lectern, not a pulpit, like, you're not there to push your personal political preference. And as a young kid taking social science classes, and then as a college student, I really hated how much my predominantly conservative economics professoriate were always shoving right-wing arguments at us all the time, just as part of the daily course curriculum. And I swore to myself, you know, that if I ever became a professor, I would not be a POV-pushing douchebag like those guys.
Okay, that's good.
I'll poke holes in the system and talk about the problems of capitalism all day long, and I'll mention liberal policy options and conservative further enclosure-oriented options, but only occasionally and, you know, briefly will I talk about big radical moves in the economy. I mean, obviously, I'm delighted to do it, but my tendency is to think, well, you should be waiting for the students to ask about that. And when I have, you know, I'm on the West Coast, I have Bernie Sanders-loving socialist students with some frequency. Like, I like to say something to challenge them. Like, well, really, where's the money going to come from? Like, as a teacher, you should be developing their critical thinking skills.
Well, when I wasn't really asking you, hey, are you indoctrinating the students like a good Marxist? Although, you know, that I can see why you read it that way. No, I was just wondering, like, you've studied, you know, economics, and as someone who's read Capital, I've been convinced by it. I just am wondering whether or not your socialism is informed by your education in economics.
I mean, that's an interesting question because it's some part of it I've had for a long time, but mainly it came out of just what I read, yeah, as a college student about how the economy works and going, sheesh, this system's really messed up. I know I mentioned earlier that I come out of, you know, my undergrad was in biology, and I had a strong plan to become a biologist. I grew up watching Carl Sagan on TV and thinking that's the good stuff. I remember, you know, and sometimes the students want to know, why did you change from biology to econ? You know, cause they're all figuring out their lives too. So I always tell them, like, when I was an undergrad in bio, that's when they sequenced the human genome for the first time. And now you can get yours done for like $7,000. But back then,
all right. Well, great. Well, listen, we talked for a good while, and I'm looking forward to releasing this. Is there something I didn't ask you or something you wanted to talk about in terms of capitalism and freedom that we didn't touch on?
Yeah, you know, I mean, to my mind, I just feel like this specific subject, like how can we increase the freedom that we have as individuals, is something that the right, the political right wing, has had a lock on for a long time. And I actually was just reading a socialist blogger the other day who was suggesting that we shouldn't, as leftists, be pushing for freedom and saying we want more freedom. He said we shouldn't do that because it's the right's brand that they have branded that. I was like, oh my God, how far we have fallen.
Right.
Historic.
Who was that, by the way?
Because I don't want to name names. And actually, I have to tell you, I can't remember the name. I can't look.
So I'm going to put him on my list for Gulag.